Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Qué Golazo. To honor the great Sir Alex Ferguson and his documentary that comes out this week, I have Peter Schmeichel joining me today to discuss the legacy of the great former Manchester United manager. We'll talk about the playing days during the 90s. We'll talk about Manchester United of now. Peter, of course, is a CBS Sports colleague as well. So we'll talk Europa League final, Champions League final. This is a fantastic conversation and Peter discusses it all. So make sure that you stay right here because Qué Golazo begins right now. There is a new documentary on the life and times of the legendary manager Sir Alex Ferguson, which you can stream on Paramount Plus from this Saturday, May 29th, the same day as the Champions League final, also on Paramount Plus and CBS. This is a film about arguably the greatest manager the game has ever seen. Sir Alex famously served Man United from 1986 to 2013, winning 13 Premier League titles, 5 FA Cups, 2 Champions League titles, and much, much more. The film is directed by Sir Alex's son, Jason, and includes insight from his wife, Lady Cathy Ferguson, as well as his other children, and of course, former players who knew him best. Well, it's an absolute pleasure to welcome one of those players, my CBS Sports colleague. It still sounds weird for me to say that. Also part of our Champions League and Europa League coverage on Paramount Plus, and one of the greatest goalkeepers the game has ever seen, Peter Schmeichel. Peter, my friend, finally, I'm super excited to welcome you to Qué Golazo and CBS Sports. How are you?
Oh, I'm good. Very good, Lewis. How are you?
I'm good. I am so excited to have you. I just wanted to tell everybody a little bit about you for a second. For those that live in a cave and have no idea, Peter Schmeichel's arrival to United from Bromby in 1991 for just about £500,000 would later be called by Sir Alex as the bargain of the century. Together, they dominated the 90s, 5 Premier League titles, 3 FA Cups, and of course, the amazing treble in 99. God, do I remember that so well, where Peter and United won the Champions League in dramatic fashion against Bayern Munich. He also has an autobiography coming out in September called One, not just about his amazing career, but also his personal life, how he nearly died at age 15 and recalls a turbulent relationship with his father, his failures, but most importantly, him picking himself up again, his successes, and much more. So, Peter, plenty to talk about, of course. Are you ready, my friend?
I'm ready. Fire away.
I love it. I love it. Peter, listen, this intro could go on and on, but you have a lot of things to do, so let's get straight into it. First off, how have you enjoyed CBS Sports? Everybody treating you well? Kate Abdo's a United fan, so I'm sure she's protective. How's it been?
No, it's been absolutely fantastic. There's a difference between broadcasting for European television. So my experience is with the UK television scene and, of course, with the Danish television scene. And now I'm experiencing, working for American TV. And there is a bit, there's a difference. There's a lot more allowed, if you like. So there's a lot of good spirits, good humor, a lot of laugh at the same time as you have to be to the point. Ideas are very quickly put into action. So, and I really like that. You can sort of grow into a way of broadcasting and be on TV and now we're all challenged with opportunities, if you like, because that's what it is. No, I'm really enjoying it. I'm working with some fantastic people. We are all been looked after very, very well. There's never been a problem with anything. It's just an absolute joy. So I really am enjoying it.
And of course, great to have you as well. What do you like better, the studio stuff or the sideline reporting?
No, I like both. I think I've got the best of both worlds. Obviously, I've been hampered with all the traveling restrictions due to COVID. So I was supposed to be, you know, when I was traveling, I was at both days, at a game every day. Before COVID, it's easy to get across Europe from literally every destination. But of course, it's been challenging. It's been quite a few countries, Germany, England, have been in complete lockdown, wouldn't let anybody in. And of course, England ended up having most of the teams in the semis. And but I went into quarantine and you know, did as much as I could. But if you take all that away, which is just the semantics, you know, I'm enjoying both. I think the studio is fantastic. Kate's doing, I mean, I'm impressed with Kate as well. I think she's a very, very, very good presenter. I like the fact that she's speaking, what is it, like 25 different languages.
Yeah, she translates.
She doesn't speak Scouse, though. That's Jamie Carragher's. That's for him. And I think it's better for her not to even attempt that, because she is, after all, from Manchester. And one day, you know, for people who don't understand that relationship between Manchester and Liverpool, I think one day we'll have to explain it. But it's not great, let me put it that way. And of course, Micah, you know, who is the happiest child I've ever met, and Roberto, who is, for me, possibly the best analyst I've ever seen on TV. It really is a joy working with them. And, you know, for me, being away, working with Alex, I worked with Alex in the final games last year. It was a pleasure. Well, Guillaume as well. I'm working with Guillaume on both finals now. And of course, Nico as well. It has been a really, really interesting year. And hopefully all these travel restrictions will lift for the next season. And it'll be easier to get around. And also, I've been in empty stadiums. I have to say, Lewis, it's. I think the players have dealt with it very well, but there's a lack of intensity, and you sense it. And I don't think it's great when you can hear everything that's been said. I know the most TV producers have been very, very clever in you know, sifting out all the bad language and most of what is being said. But my God, I don't enjoy that. I don't think that's nice. You know, football is, we don't play football for ourselves. We play football for the fans. So we need them back as quickly as possible. So hopefully that would happen as well. And the next season in the Champions League will be more interesting.
Yeah, so it was good to see all the fans back, at least in the last two games of the Premier League, as we have seen, right? You felt good about that? Did I feel good at least to see some of the fans, some of the normality coming back?
Yeah, I think we're used to the Premier League to sell out crowds. Every game is a sellout. So even you know, only seeing some fans back and empty seats, which is something that we're not used to, even that was brilliant. And you straight away you sense that the pressure that the fans can put on their own players, on the opponent's players, but also on the referees, it has an effect. So in the last couple of games, the FA Cup, the Premier League games that we've seen crowds back in, we've sensed a difference, a little shift in. It's very difficult to say precisely what, but there has been a shift. Players have reacted differently, and so has referees. So, I tell you what, in terms of when it comes to players and how good they are and talent and all that, that for me is going to be the most interesting thing for when we get them back and when we get full houses again. Because a lot of players have popped up in the last sort of 12, 15, 18 months and made a name for themselves. But they've made a name for themselves in an environment with no pressure other than off on the pitch. There's no pressure from the crowd. There's no, I mean, if you play for Man United, for instance, which is, I would, even though it's been a while since we won the Premier League and made any big waves in Europe in terms of the Champions League, I still consider that the biggest club in the world in terms of the following, and every time something happens at Man United, well, it's the most written, talked about thing in the whole world. You know, to play for Man United, of course, you gotta have the talent, you gotta have the skills, and gotta, but I tell you what, you must have the mentality. If you don't have the mentality, if you're not a strong personality, there's no way you can hack it at Man United. This just doesn't happen. And we've seen a couple of players, you know, sneak into the team that they look okay. But I want to see them under pressure. I want to see them when the crowds are there. I want to see them when they play away from home and everybody hates them. How are they reacting then? So that's going to be, for me, the most interesting thing for when we get the fans back. How are the players reacting?
Yeah, that's going to be key. And obviously, as we talk about Sir Alex Ferguson in a second and, you know, your times then, the 90s, if you're a young listener right now, Manchester United, there was no team that was hated more than Manchester United.
loved.
Or loved if you're a United fan, or actually a neutral away. That's right. But I grew up in England. I'm a Villa fan. My dad was a United fan, and you just know too well. But it came out of respect, Peter Schmeichel. It was because, like, this is a team that everybody really knew. The Red Devils are coming. You better watch out.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting thing when you say the 90s. Yes, of course, in the 90s, we managed to win 5 Premier League. So the Premier League, the first Premier League champions were crowned in 93. So we are a little bit into the 90s. Up until then, Man United was a club or a team that came very near, but always stumbled at the end. Mm. Never really had the ability to take it over the line, or so it seemed. At least from the outside, and I think if you speak to observers around that time, that's what they would claim. But when you speak and when you talk to the inside, so you know, people like the old owner, chairman Martin Edwards, or Mike Edison, who's still a director at the football club, Morris Watkins, also a director of the football club. When you speak to these guys, Bobby Charlton as well. They knew what was happening internally. They knew what was happening, how the club was being structured by Alex Ferguson, how he was very, very slowly getting rid of players who took the culture or the environment in the opposite or a different direction as to what he wanted it to, where he wanted to go. And also the way that he was attempting, I won't say attempting because it was very deliberate, but you know, structuring the education as footballers, putting the right people in charge. Eric Harrison, Brian Kidd were in charge of the first sort of crop of incredible players that the club produced, known as the class of 92, the Beckhams, the Giggs, Nicky Butt, Paul Scholes, and Neville Brothers. That was all deliberate. But of course, that was something into the future. So Alex Ferguson came in 86, November 86, and never won the championship. So, and that would be the first Premier League until 93. That's a long, long, long time to go as a manager who was always, to his own mind, right. So he knew this is the way we're going. Follow me, or you follow off. That or you fall off. That's it. So to go for that long without, I know there was an FA Cup, and of course there was a Cup Winners' Cup very late on before the championship was won. To go to that, go that long without winning the championship and still having that mentality, that's a long time. But people from the inside knew this was happening. They had all the patience in the world. It didn't happen for anyone after Sir Matt Busby. So they knew this was the right guy. They were backing him to the hilt. And there you go. If you give someone with the right idea, the correct idea, time to, first of all, get rid of players. I mean, you come in as a new manager, you got to get rid of players.
Yeah.
Because you always come in at a bad time. Why is it a bad time? Because the players are not good enough. You got to get rid of players. He did that. Took him a long time.
Would this happen now, do you think? Would he get that kind of time now?
Not a chance. Unfortunately, not a chance. I think there are always examples of football clubs trying to do the right thing, trying to give people time and trying to organize themselves. I think where my son plays, Leicester City is a very good example of, you know, organizing yourself right, get your recruitment right, you know, slowly build. You know, they just opened. I haven't seen it yet because of COVID, but they've now opened the best training facility in the world, spent the most money. They're now extending the stadium. That's the next project. But they're building. And you can see, you know, they won the Premier League. They won the FA Cup on Saturday. That's very good. But when you look at what they've done, you know, they've not given any managers that much time. They sacked Sven. Sven Göran Eriksson was the first manager when Kasper was there. So he got sacked within a year, you know, and then there's been a succession of different coaches there. Due to different things, you know, one of them got sacked because he insulted the owners. But due to different things, they haven't kept the same manager for that period of time. So even a club that is doing it right is not going to give the manager that much time.
Yeah. So with that being said, Peter, how do you think Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is doing right now? Or how is he done?
I think he's doing very well. I think he is. It's an unsteady ship, and he's steering it very with a steady hand. It is not an easy job that he's got. I think he's benefited from not having fans in the stadium. He's had that factor less to contend with in this incredibly difficult period. It's no secret that the football club that the fans love is very much detached from the ownership of the club. And we all know what happened 3 weeks ago with the Europa Super League and how that within 48 hours changed football completely. And of course, this is like 2 years in for Ole Gunnar, but it's still something that's going to rock the boat. He's going to be faced with that. But I think he's done well. Again, what's going to happen when the fans come back in? You know, if you lose the number of games at home that he's done this season, the fans won't be happy. They're going to go all the out straight away. This is what the Manchester United fans are doing. That's how they react to results like that. So, again, he's had a tough time with players that he's never picked. He never signed them for the club. And, you know, for him to take the club to the next level, you know, he's got to sign some players that fit into how he sees the game going.
Who would you want this summer if you could pick someone? You have somebody in mind?
I would like Harry Kane to come to Man United.
Yeah.
I definitely like Harry Kane. I also would like someone like Fofana from Leicester.
Yeah.
Because I think we're exposed. I think we've been, you know, Harry Maguire gets injured and then we see what happened. You know, we are a nervous bunch of defenders. We need a Vidic Ferdinand combination kind of thing going. And I can see Harry Maguire, Fofana do that. I think Lindelof is a fantastic player, but Lindelof is unfortunately not that leader that you want in a center defender. If you look back in history at the times where Manchester United, in Premier League history, every center half has won the Premier League.
Yeah.
As a leader. Every single one of them. Steve Bruce, Gary Pallister, Jaap Stam, Ronnie Janssen, Henning Berg, Vidic, Ferdinand, all these guys, they've been leaders, absolute led from the, and I think that is a requirement to score goals. If you're Man United, to score goals, you have to commit people forward. More people than other teams have to do, because people have more respect, they're more defensively minded, and therefore you have to have more people up front. So you got to take risks and chances. And to do that, you definitely have to have strong centre-halves who can, you know, live life back there on their own, and also, you know, at the same time as trying to defend, still lead and direct other players.
I could not agree with you more. It's something that I've talked about for a long time, because it's not just Manchester United. Look at Vincent Kompany and Man City, Ruben Dias and Man City now. Look at Tony Adams and Arsenal. Yeah. Look at Chelsea and John Terry. There is a clear Virgil van Dijk and Liverpool. There is a clear importance and focus to have a vertebrae, a backbone. Yeah. And it begins at the back in front of your goalkeeper. It's a good point.
I believe that it begins with the goalkeeper. First, you build your spine. So you have your goalkeeper. You know, your goalkeeper, you want your goalkeeper to be steady. That's it. You don't necessarily want the guy who flies in the corners and saves, and then, you know, he makes a mistake or doesn't come for a cross, or, you know, you just want steady Eddie in there. Someone that is so reliable. Someone that the two guys in front of you understands completely and trusts. That goes the other way as well. So the two guys in front of the goalkeeper has to be the same. So they've got to be strong, really strong, independent thinking, team thinking, and also leaders. Those two guys are so important. Then you've got to have, you know, midfield players who can, you know, go box to box. As I said before, you've got to commit people forward. So you need your midfield players up there. But when you defend, you also want them back. So you need that as well. And then at the end of the day, that's why I said Harry Kane first. It's a total cliche. I know that. But goals change games. It's as simple as that. So if you got someone proven like Harry Kane who sticks in 25 a year in you know, a relatively ordinary team like Tottenham, right? What's he going to do in Man United? You look at all the other guys that came into Man United. We took Dwight York of you, right?
Yes. Don't remind me.
32 goals in his first season.
Yep.
All he had to do, and he will say that himself, all I had to do was to read David Beckham's crosses. Just read them.
Yeah.
And then be in the and then just stick a head to it. Now, Man United has always produced a lot of chances. Always produced a lot of chances. Can you imagine someone like Harry Kane who produces, I mean, this is, I don't have an official stat, but top of my head, produces 60% of his own chances? Would that be fair to say?
Yeah.
Can you imagine him at Man United being serviced the way that strikers at Man United are?
Yeah, with Bruno Fernandes and, yeah.
So if you have that spine, then you have the Greenwoods, the Rashfords, and all these kind of players that you know, are the spices that you... Yeah, you beef the food up with the dish up with them. It's difficult. I would say, you know, if you really cut to the chase, it's more than two players.
Yeah.
It's a lot more than two players, actually. But you can't do that. You have to start somewhere, and you gotta transmit or do that transmission slowly. You can't just put five new players on the pitch. Very, very rarely does that happen.
Well, I mean, you know, to your point, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has done well. Champions League once again, and the Europa League final as well this week as you are listening to this. By the way, what are your thoughts on the Europa League final against Villarreal and Unai Emery? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, we're up against a guy who's won it three times before. You know, I think we're all struggling to sort of name Villarreal players. You know, who are they?
Well, Gerard Moreno is a striker.
Yeah. But my point is different. My point is not that we cannot. Of course we can. But we don't know this team as individuals. Yeah. What we do know is that this is a very, very well-organized team. And I think it's been proven again and again in this side of the Europa League. how will all, I mean, to go to the Emirates and play for 0-0, that's not easy. It's never easy. But they did that, and I would say they were comfortable in that 0-0 draw.
Undefeated in the whole tournament, Peter. Undefeated in the whole tournament.
So Unai Emery is very, very experienced at this kind of game. That's a big difference. You know, it's a really, really big difference in playing in Europe and playing this side of the tournament, so the knockout phase, and then playing 38 games in the Premier League. It's very, very different. Mindset is different. Tactics are different. You have to relate to something you've already done if you're playing the second leg. And, you know, and when you get to the final, you have one shot. That's one shot, 90 minutes, maybe 120, but 90 minutes, you got to get it right. And for someone like him to be there again with that experience and the team that he's put, I mean, I'm so impressed with that team. I am, really am.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be very, very difficult for Manchester United, unfortunately. I really am hoping that Harry Maguire will be fit. It's a big, big worry for me that if he's not playing. Yeah. I think even when he played in the Roma game in Rome, I was embarrassed to watch that game. And the number of chances we conceded, and thank God for David De Gea, you know, we could have been knocked out, by the way.
Yeah.
But we've shown frailties in defense. We have. But he's a steady, steady player. So at least we have one steady player. So that's a big, big worry for me if he's not playing. It is.
Would you start Edinson Cavani, Peter?
Of course I would.
You would?
Of course. The guy's on fire.
El matador.
Yeah, exactly. I've always liked him. I mean, from Napoli to PSG, I always liked this guy. I always liked him. And of course, it doesn't sit right with me that we get those kind of players at the end of their careers. But I have to be honest, it wasn't a positive signing for me. I wasn't happy about it.
Yeah.
I'm thinking we're taking steps backwards. We're not going to go backwards and get players who are, 33, 34, 35 to finish their career at another big club. That's not what we want. We want guys that we can have in there for 5, 8, 10 years. And also, you know, at the beginning, he wasn't playing him. And it was like, and then suddenly, my God, somebody was lighting a match. He is on fire, and he's brilliant. It looks like he might have been a bit injured, and then he's now found his fitness. But he is sharp. My God, the goal he scored against Fulham. But it just you can't teach anybody that. That is instinct, an instinct for a striker. You know, as soon as you make the run, even before you touch the ball, you have an instinct about what I'm going to do with this. It's a goalkeeper out. If he is, I'm going to do that. Wow.
Yeah.
I would start him any game. Of course I would.
Yeah. No, absolutely. All right. Let's switch gears for a second because I want to talk about very quickly about, you know, Sir Alex Ferguson, because you know, when we talk about Sir Alex Ferguson, we've talked about it a little bit in the past just now, discussing, you know, what it would be like for him to manage right now. But just, I know it's very difficult in one segment to do this, but Peter, what was it like to work under Sir Alex Ferguson?
I loved every minute of it. Absolutely. I loved it. There was clarity about, you know, everything. You know, what direction are we taking? What's required of me? What's required of the team? It was very well communicated. And of course, if you're not on that track, you're leaving the club. You kind of knew that. And then people have a different impression of Sir Alex than I have.
Misconception.
I actually consider him one of the nicest people I've ever met in my life.
What do other people think there?
They see the brood. They've seen the interviews. They've seen when they've only seen like the public Sir Alex at work. because that wasn't work. He was so deliberate in everything he did. When he was doing interviews, he was either speaking to us in the dressing room, or he was taunting the other team or the manager, not the team, but the manager.
Right.
He loved that. I mean, he, you know, one year he really got Kevin Keegan up there, which I think was significant. But he was at work in those TV interviews. He didn't do that for the pleasure of the TV station. He had a clear message and knew precisely what it was that he was communicating every time. Every time he went in front of a microphone, that was a plan. And he never spoke badly about a player. Never did. Never. He might have, in sort of retrospectively, said something, or, you know, everyone knows, you know, the Yapstam, the book, the misunderstanding. And there you go. He's a big, big, big man, you know. Comes out to, hey, I made a mistake. I'm sorry. And he did. So, and I like that. You know, when you have a boss, I think the most valuable asset that a boss can have is clarity. So whatever is, that's what it is. It never changes. So if he says ba ba ba, he said it, and then that's gone. Never comes back to it. And I like that about him. Really, really like. I loved working with him.
Yeah, he was very, you know, what you see, like the relationship was very pure. There was nothing hidden. There was nothing unsubtle. It was whatever I say, this is the truth. This is what I'm telling.
Yeah, I think when you take it inside, that's definitely the case. I think when you sort of, if you look at sort of the broader picture and his public persona and his public work, the way he worked his team publicly, I think that's a lot of play acting and a lot of deliberate taunting of people to get them off balance, simply. Yeah. I think that's not the guy he is, but that was just part of how he did his work. And you know, I was on the inside. I saw something else. So I was quite happy with that.
Yeah, no, of course. Listen, there's a great story on how you joined United from Bromby, because it didn't happen straight away, right? You were a little disappointed the first time the team's going to meet a fee, this agreed to a fee. And then your agent tells you to go to his house and there was Sir Alex Ferguson. Is that right?
Yeah. that story is in my book. Can't give that away.
the reason why I say it is because you have said it before in a podcast, in the United podcast. So I was very interested to hear. You don't have to tell me the whole thing. Obviously, I want people to buy your book.
But it was. I mean, I was a small child of eight when I first started to think about and dream about playing for Man United.
Yeah.
And. You know, it was a driving force. I mean, I was 27 when I joined the club. So, you know, for a very, very long time, it was more like the impossible dream, a dream. And then I had the opportunity, and the club I was at asked for far too much money, which it sounds ridiculous now, but it's 1.1 million.
Well, back then it was a lot. Yeah, back then it was a lot.
it was a lot. But it just sounds ridiculous when you say that. And it didn't happen. And then, you know, a couple of months into the following season, this is at the end of the season.
Yeah.
So a couple of months later, I get a call from an assistant to my agent. And he said, come to my house after training. And I did. And Alex Ferguson was there. And he just said, listen, I know what I want. Just keep working hard. Just do the same thing. And play well, and I'll come back for you. And that's another measure of the man, you know. He says something, and then he did. Yeah. He came back for me.
Amazing. It's just amazing. And like what you just said, right? His word is true, and he meant it. And look what happened after that. You know what I'm interested in is that, you know, all qualities that are attributed to Sir Alex, but I feel like no manager has ever embraced the grit, the desire to just win. I just saw an interview with Gary Neville talking to him saying, and how Sir Alex is like, you know, we're in the final minutes of a game and some teams just want to hold back or whatever. I will never understand why, because it was about, no matter what, to just gamble and go for that victory. Would you, Did you feel that every day in training and in the dressing room? I mean, so many incredible moments of coming back. Of course, the most famous one against Bayern Munich. But is that what he emphasized every day?
No.
I love it. Why not?
No.
So what did he emphasize?
Not every day. There's a very big difference.
Match day and training.
Massive difference. So yeah. In actual fact, he didn't really want us to do much in training. His sessions were short. He never took training himself, but sessions were always short. Intensity was always low. Brian Kidd took it upon himself to do some of the more intensive work when he was not around, because he felt that we needed that. But he wanted us to be fresh for matches.
Interesting. Did that annoy some players?
I mean, it's one of the things, I tell you what, it's one of the things I very much enjoyed working with him, was that we put everything on the line, every time.
Yeah.
All the time. We never hold anything back. He would, it's happened in my time, it's happened on two occasions. Not that he said in so many words that we should be holding back, because we were about to really humiliate a team, but he made subs that stopped our momentum, because he didn't want to kill, you know, the team that we were playing against, off, or maybe the manager. But he also had, there's also a couple of examples where he said, listen, now, you know, you go for it, keep going, even though we were, you know, way ahead.
Yeah.
But I like the whole risking the whole thing. I talk about my book again. I'm sorry about it. It's not that I wanted to.
I want you to talk about your book.
But I think I start the first chapter of my book.
Yeah.
It's called Risk Mode. I think it's the first chapter. I'm not sure. It's called Risk Mode. And I go into detail about all this. And very, very detailed about, you know, what we're thinking, what we're happening, and why we're doing stuff. And it's something that, it's something, so for me at all to write this book, it's one big why. Why was I was 8 years old. I lived in Copenhagen, which is a different country to where Manchester is. I hardly had any football on TV back then. We're in the early 70s. I mean, how could I say that this is what I wanted to do? And I ended up doing that. And my dream was winning the FA Cup at Wembley for Manchester United. That was my dream every night. So how come this came true? That was my beginning point. So in order to go through all that, and, you know, I've dug really deep into my family history and stuff like that, I also came through to these questions. Why did we keep doing that? You know, I had to really think hard about it. And where did it all come from? And, you know, I won't say that it was a deliberate thing that he put into our minds, but it was definitely something that he allocated for, you know. That was with him, there was always an opportunity to do something that he hadn't thought about himself. And when you bring a group of players together that, without having, you know, even spoken the words between us, but we have the same, we want to do this.
Yeah.
And I don't care if we lose 2 or 3-0, but if I can get it to 1-1, then I'm a winner, you know. And we had that. So still credit the manager, absolutely credit Alex Ferguson for that, because he picked us. So he looked for all these kind of things. And then he brought us together. And then it's part of the reason that it took him so long to win the championship, was he needed to get that mixture completely right. Because you could have players with that mentality, but then flaws in other departments.
Yeah.
So once you got there, then it became easy, of course. It became easy. Because then the players he brought in, they had to adapt to the environment. But in the run into the first Premier League win, you know, we had to create the environment. And he was, of course, a very, he played a massive, massive part in that.
Yeah. You left at such a high note, right? After winning the treble, etc. Do you sometimes look back? And by the way, I don't want you to think like this, because I was so happy when you joined Villa a few years later after that. But would you would you, do you sometimes think, oh, I probably could have stayed a few more years? Was it your choice, first of all?
Well, my choice, definitely.
And do you think that you could have stayed a few more years?
There's circumstances.
Yeah.
I think with COVID, we've seen a little bit of what a compressed fixture calendar can do to players. If you look across the clubs, I mean, Man City's been very good. They haven't really, but they have two completely equally strong teams. They can mix and chop, so they can rest players, but they are just about the only club.
Yeah.
Most clubs will have to play their best players and most of their best players every time. And, you know, you're getting through periods where you play again. So you've mentioned our 99 season, right? So in the last 14 games we played, last 14 games, every single one of them had carried the importance of a cup final.
Yeah.
Every single one of them.
And you felt that. When you watched it, you just felt it. Yeah.
At no point, and then look back, if you look back, at no point could we have done worse than what we did. We won by 1 point to Arsenal for the Premier League title. You know, we were cutting it fine in the semi-final of the FA Cup. Yes, we had an easy ride in there in the actual FA Cup final. That was probably the easiest game we had in the run-up to the final. And then the Champions League final, you know. But you look at those 14 games, they were played with an interval of 3.8 days. Every 3.8 day, you have a cup final. So mentally, of course, it takes its toll, more than anything when it's over. But it kind of, you know, when you get on the ride, you just stay there and the momentum carries you to the next. But physically, you carry all sorts of knocks. And I think the science says that between the ideal period, rest period between football games, 5 days, you know, 5 days or more. So you can imagine, you know, playing these kind of games. You have to play your best players. And, you know, I absolutely insisted on playing every time. So there was no question about that. And then I got to the end of the World Cup, which was the end of that year. No, sorry.
Yeah, that's right. My God.
But I got to the end of the World Cup the previous year. That was
the 98, yeah, in France, yeah.
Yeah, the 98. We played Brazil, I think, on July 2nd, something like that. And 4 weeks later, less than 4 weeks actually, we had to play qualification to get into the Champions League because we were runners-up in the Premier League. And back then, the runners-up had to go through the playoffs to get into the Champions League. So, you know, already then, I mean, I hardly stopped playing this massive tournament that the World Cup is. I had to play the most important games of the season because we had to be in the Champions League.
Yeah.
And I kind of looked this mountain. It was that steep, you know. I just couldn't find the energy to carry on like that. Because for 3.5 years, I didn't have a holiday because I had an operation there at the European Championships. And then, you know, it's just, and I was so mentally so drained coming back from the World Cup. So I decided, okay, this is it. This is going to be my last season.
You made that decision right after the World Cup.
Yeah,
did you tell anybody?
Yeah, I'm giving too much away here, you know.
you can give what you want or not. It's just very, you know, it's an act. You got to understand, like, talking to you is well, the point is that you, because of what's going on with COVID and how many play, I mean, look at Bruno Fernandes. He plays every single game. Yeah. Every single game.
He insists that, but you need that. That's it. This I feel is a big misunderstanding with modern day football, because why do they need to be rested? I mean, why? What is it? Why can't they just play every game? Of course you can, but sometimes you will get a rest. But your best players should play. You know, so if you think about sort of the wider content of football, right? To play a season like Man City they've done and been able to change and just bring quality for quality all the time, you need two teams of quality. But can you imagine if every of the top teams in Europe, they have that. How many players that are not in the other teams, and how bad the competition would be. Look at the Premier League this year. It's brilliant, man. We don't know who's going to be in Europe next. Or we know who's going to be in Europe, or most of it. We don't know who's going to be in the Champions League. We don't know. I mean, Man City ran away with it. Man United, they secured second place the other day.
Right, but Liverpool, Chelsea, Leicester City still fighting.
Isn't that brilliant? That's what you want. That was a big, big misunderstanding that the clubs behind the European Super League. That was a big misunderstanding that they never catered for. That's what people want. Look at the championship, the next second best league. Look at the competition there. It's absolutely brilliant. Look at France. Look at Spain. How good is it? I mean, Spain's probably had the most exciting finish to a season for years.
Yeah.
That is what you want. But if you take all the best players in the world, and you just put them into what? Let's just say 10 or 12 teams. You know? Then where is the competition? Where's
Peter, your son's team. Look at Leicester City and what they did. I feel like it's remarkable. Yeah. The complete antithesis to European Super League. Absolutely.
Yeah. I really, truly believe that that's the best run club in the country. In England.
Leicester City?
I think they are. I mean, I know people are going to talk about them possibly falling out of the top four again, and it can happen, you know. But no one's talked about their injury situation. They have been hit as bad, and maybe even worse.
Key players out for a while. Jamie Vardy was out for a while. James Maddison was out for a while. Like, you know, it's been rough. It's been very rough for them.
Johnny Evans been out at the beginning of the season.
Johnny Evans, a huge player for them.
You know,
yeah.
Harvey Barnes, you know. Hey, James Justin is out, you know, Ricardo's been out. I mean, literally the whole team, apart from maybe two, three players, they've been out. But you never, ever heard Brendan Rodgers complain about that. He just carried on. He shuffled his deck of cards. Okay, his bench substitutes looked a bit young at times, maybe a bit thin, but he just carried on. And look at where they are. Won the FA Cup.
First time in their history.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what football is all about. You know, it's not about how many players can you buy and then just, you know, chop and change and, you know, I don't find that exciting. I find the competition and that a Leicester thing can happen. I find that so important for football, and it was the best thing that ever happened after the European Super League that Leicester went on and won the FA Cup because it kind of pushed romance back into football straight away. You can't just kind of argue with that. The owner came on the pitch. He was picked. Kasper went up and, you know, got him down there. You know, you could see the love between the players and the fans and the owner. I mean, it was beautiful. And football, this is what we want with football. We want that emotion. We want that caring for, but we want the competition. That is the most important thing. Because if that goes, then why are we playing?
Well said, my friend. Well said. One final question, because you're also part, obviously, as we mentioned, of our Champions League final coverage. I'll be doing the USA part. You'll be doing the UK part. First of all, are you going to be there, right? Are you going to be silent or studio?
I'm going to be there. Yes, I'm going to be in Porto. Yeah.
I love it. I love it. Well, let's talk very quickly. Man City, Chelsea. What do you think? All Premier League final. Chelsea has gone the better after of Man City this season. But what do you think? Third time lucky. How's Pep Guardiola going to take this one?
Well, I think actually, if I'm honest, I think Chelsea are the favourites.
Interesting.
I think they are. I mean, of course, Thomas Tuchel was in the final last year.
Yep.
You don't want to go into the final and lose for the second year running. He's got a better team. I'm not sure that he's found his best 11 yet, but he's got a really strong team. You saw him on Tuesday, how they played against Leicester. They are like a pack of wolves, just chasing. And of course, if you can keep up with that, you have a chance, but it's very difficult to keep up with that.
Especially against Man City.
Yes. The one thing, and that this is probably the main reason that I say that Chelsea might just be slight favourites here, is because they've already won two games against Man City this season. Pep is a clever manager. I mean, he's done so fantastically well. But if there's a little weakness with Pep, is that he can overthink his tactics.
Oh, he did last season.
Yep. Yeah, that sometimes confuses the players. And that, I think, because he's lost twice already, I think he will consider a way to play against Chelsea. Not consider a way that you play your team, but against Chelsea the way they play. And yes, of course, he's already sealed the championship. He's had time to work on that. But sometimes, you know, you get to this final, it's such a big event. What you don't want is too much information in your head or be shackled by, you know, a tactics that you've not sort of practiced in a match. Or you want to have a little bit of freedom. You want to have the opportunity to go and express yourself and chase the game. You want to win the game. But if your manager said, oh, we've got to do this and that, and you have to hold back from something that you instinctively think that you should have done, it can take, you know, just the edge off. And that's why I think Chelsea, they are slight favorites.
Slight favorites. Interesting. I'm very interested. I wonder if that will change your mind, but I think that you're a man of your word and you're probably going to stick with that all the way until Saturday, Peter Schmeichel. I'm not sure. I'm going with Man City, but who knows, huh? It's a game that can happen anywhere.
Everyone goes with Man City. And it's not because I want to be opposite. It's just, you know, I mean, a lot of things can change this week. So when we get to Sunday, Chelsea's got to go to Aston Villa and get, I have a feeling they need to win to stay in the top four.
I agree.
Leicester, they've got Tottenham at home. Yeah. I have a feeling to have a chance they need to win that, and I think they will. And of course, Liverpool will be in the top four because they just need to win the next game, which is Crystal Palace at home. And why wouldn't it?
Yeah. You know,
why wouldn't they win that game? So we can have a situation where Chelsea finishes fifth, and then if they win the Champions League, they will qualify for next year,
which gives them the Premier League an extra team in the tournament as well.
Yeah. They have two chances. And I think that there's a chance they might miss the first one, and that gives them that little extra, I think.
Well, I mean, you know, as a Villa fan, I would love nothing more than to take 3 points against that. We didn't even talk about your goal for Villa, by the way. I was there. It was amazing. Of course, I grew up in England, my friend.
Oh. Yeah, I know, but this is away from home, wasn't it?
Yeah, but I still went. I still went.
Did you go to all the away games?
Not all of them. It was very difficult. No. Obviously, I lived in London, just outside of London, but I went to every game that I could away, and then I went to, obviously, to Villa Park. But seeing you play for Villa, I know it wasn't that long.
Yeah, and I
know
that I have to say, I like it. I mean, John Gregory was a manager that signed me. I thought he...
Loved John Gregory.
I do as well. I mean, I thought he was fantastic. He was... I mean, no one's like Fergie, but he had something about him. And he was a very modern way of thinking manager. He was involving the players, the experienced players, when he was doing his talks and when he was doing tactics, and he would never just say, players, do this, do that. He always, you know, not in a team talk when, you know, the game was being played 3 hours later, then everything had to be said. But in training, you know, he would talk about it. What do you feel about this? Do you think I have this? I mean, I love that about him. And he stood up for his beliefs. I mean, that's why he left the job.
That's right. He stuck to his guns the entire time.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, listen, Peter Schmeichel, honestly, like, I could do this for 3 more hours, but I know that you've got things to do, probably get ready for Porto as well. But please, everybody, make sure that A, you follow him on social media. B, watch him on CBS and Paramount Plus. Buy his book, C, as well. By the way, that you just talking about Sir Alex Ferguson was just so great as well, because the movie, the documentary will come out on the Champions League Day.
Watch it. I mean, by all means, this is an interesting man. This is a man that came from absolutely nothing. I mean, I know where I came from. I've been to that place.
Yeah.
No disrespect to the people from there. But to break out from there and do what he's done, it's just an absolutely amazing, amazing story. And to have such clarity of what you want to do and how you want to do it, it's very few people in the world who's ever done that, but he was one of them. So watch it. It's really, I haven't seen it myself, but I'm absolutely convinced it's going to be a fantastic watch.
Well, my friend, you were part of the story anyway, so I'm sure you don't even need to watch it as you are part of that story as well. And it's amazing. But Peter Schmeichel, again, a pleasure, my friend, and the best to you. And let's talk soon, because, you know, you are my colleague, so I got every right to talk to you anytime I want to.
You have, and you have my number.
I do. Peter Schmeichel, thank you so much, my friend.
Thanks, Lewis. Take care.
Take care, buddy. Take care.
And see you at the final.
Yes, sir.
Or the finals.
Absolutely. Hey, everybody. I want to thank Peter Schmeichel for joining me today. Don't forget to watch Sir Alex Ferguson's documentary on Paramount Plus this Saturday on the day of the Champions League final, May 29. Make sure that you follow us on Twitter, Qué Golazo Pod. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, YouTube, youtube.com/Qué Golazo, and so much more. Have a great, great rest of your week. Enjoy the rest of the games and, of course, the Champions League final and the documentary. Have a good one.
Streaming on Paramount Plus.
You're ready, Bob.
Well, all right.
Audiences are raving. Bob Marley is electrifying. It's the feel-good movie of the year.
You dig?
Bob Marley: One Love. Rated PG-13. Now streaming on Paramount Plus.